Such is the pace of new research and discovery that a science text must be revised every 3 years, recast every 5 years, and entirely rewritten every decade. It is a matter of note, therefore, that when some of the best minds of our country assembled on Thanksgiving weekend last on the campus of the University of Chicago to hear some 50 papers debating and discussing a textbook in the biological sciences written and published exactly 100 years before. The subjects of this convocation was Charles Robert Darwin's The Origin of Species. Darwin's work has weathered the shifting scientific climates of opinion of the last century as testament indeed to its merit. It is all the more surprising in that the book itself is dry, often prosaic in style, pedantic, and that, of course, it suffers from being scientifically archaic. Vast new discoveries in the fields of paleontology and embryology and genetics enable modern man to understand his evolution far better than did Charles Darwin. What then makes The Origin of Species still the subject of lively debate? This book shares with a very few others in world history the claim to have brought to man a new dimension of thought. We can see our world only with the eyes with which we are taught to see. Until Copernicus published his theories on the revolutions of planets, man could only look on this world as the center of the universe, with the sky and an envelope protecting him, circumscribing his world. Copernicus taught us to think of the world as part of a larger solar system. And until Galileo published his dialogues, man could only think of our solar system as the center of all that is. Galileo taught us to see the universe as a vast entity of which our solar system was but one rather small infinitesimal part. And until Newton, man was unable to comprehend the texture, the basis of all that existed outside of his world. Newton taught us to see the microcosm and the macrocosm as one, as related chemically in terms of energy and in terms of matter and mass. Like Galileo and Copernicus and Newton before him, like Einstein and Freud after his day, Darwin gave us a new framework of thought, a new insight into our world. He gave us the theory of evolution. He gave to our bodies a new history, a new dimension in time. For he taught that all the animals and plants that we see came into being not full-blown, not as we know them, but rather they developed, they changed and grew out of more primitive, simpler forms, possibly ultimately out of some one or two simple life living organisms. And Darwin's theory of evolution enabled us to explain many things. It taught us why we have in our bodies certain vestigial organs which no longer play a function in keeping us alive and helping us adapt to our environment. It taught us why the big toes of our feet are prehensile in character, seemingly capable of grasping on and holding on to limbs. It taught us why the human embryo in its development seems to recapitulate the structure and function of more primitive living forms. It taught us why we find a mammal like the whale swimming in the sea. It taught us why there were on our earth in ancient days, dinosaurs and mastodon, huge animals who have left us a fossil relic, but no other living testimony. The theory of evolution taught man many things about himself and about the nature, natural world in which he lived. It taught us that we have a history that reaches back billions of years, 2 or 3 billions of years, to the beginning of simple virus or bacteria life here on our Earth. It is then, of course, not surprising that since Darwin's view was essentially an historical one, his own theory had a history, a long and quite proud history. The ancient Greeks and the ancient Jews both had some idea that lower forms developed into higher forms. One of the great Greek philosophers, Anaximander, even made the startling for his age guess that the human body as we know it was a development of the body of the fish. In the 14th century, the Jewish medieval scholar Levi ben Gersonides, suggested that the story of creation in Genesis, which was read to you this morning, was simply an attempt to indicate the higher forms of life had developed from the lower forms. In the century which preceded the publication in 1859 of The Origin of Species, many men, including Darwin's own grandfather, had toyed with the idea of evolution, had done research attempting to prove its existence. But none of them had been able to account for the many idiosyncrasies, the vagaries, the incongruities of the order of animal and flower life as men knew it. None of them had been able to substantiate scientifically the theory of evolution. Darwin then did not innovate, he did not initiate or invent the doctrine of evolution. Rather, it is to his credit that he lent scientific credibility to this doctrine. After the publication of The Origin of Species, it was not given to any thinking man to pass off the concept of evolution as an interesting but as yet unproven, unacceptable bit of speculation. Who then was this man who at the age of 40 became one of the immortals of our cultural and scientific history? I like to think of Charles Darwin is one of the most improbable of immortals. In his youth, there was nothing that we could label precocious. His school record was anything but impressive. Family influence secured him an appointment to the medical college in Edinburgh. An absolute indifference to his studies secured him the opportunity to choose some other profession in life. Family influence secured for Charles Darwin enrollment at Cambridge University for a degree in the classics leading to the Anglican ministry. He secured that degree, but his record at Cambridge was more of that of a fun-loving playboy than that of a future immortal scholar. Degree in hand, the young Darwin confronted his family with the announcement that he was not prepared to enter the ministry. He was not prepared to settle down to work. He wanted adventure. He wanted to travel. He wanted romance. His father, in a letter which is preserved, bitterly denounced his son as a wastrel and a scoundrel. You will bring disgrace upon yourself and upon our whole family. You think of nothing but shooting and the dogs and rat catching. That is all. But surprisingly, the travel which Darwin sought as an escape proved to bind him to his life's work. A friend of the family's who was a professor of biology and botany at Cambridge University secured for the young Darwin an appointment as naturalist aboard a Royal Navy map-making ship bound for several years of work in the South American waters and in the South Seas. Darwin was appointed to as naturalist of the Majesty's ship Beagle. And for 5 years aboard the Beagle, it was his task to classify and to describe the flora and the fauna found on the shores near which his ship was making its soundings and writing out the chart for the benefit of the Royal Navy. Darwin found this work challenging and interesting. He did his work well. And he was intrigued by some of the questions, the philosophic questions, which it seemed to present. Why was it, for instance, he began to ask himself, that the animal and vegetable life of an offshore island tended to be similar to the animal and vegetable life on the mainland? Yet, visibly, there was no means of passage between the two. Why was it as his ship went southward towards the pole and changed from climactic zone to climactic zone, animal life and vegetable life changed in turn? And asking and puzzling over these problems, Darwin began to develop the interest in evolution, which was to be his life's work. Returning to England after 5 years of travel, Darwin now had a new, compelling interest. But he was still unwilling to settle down. He married. He married the daughter of the man who manufactured the famous Wedgwood pottery in China. And he refused every offer from his prosperous father-in-law and from his prosperous father to settle down in the family business. He had an interest, an intellectual interest, but he refused every offer from the great English universities to teach his new discipline on their campuses. At 31, Darwin fulfilled the hope of many of us. He retired. And from that time to his death, he lived the life of a country squire, puttering in his garden, reading leisurely in his library, working over his important collections of fossils and animal life which he had brought back from his travels, thinking and writing and researching. And 24 years of such slow-paced, unhurried research gave the world the origin of species and a new framework of thought. This is his biography, and this is what makes me consider him as one of the most unhurried and relaxed of geniuses and intellectual heroes our world has ever known. Darwin had come to the conclusion that there must be the possibility of change between species and species. Individual species were differentiated among themselves, but there was also a great deal of similarity found between the lower forms of animal life and the higher forms in both structure and function. Many had sensed the same thing. The question was, how did this change take place? How scientifically could we account for this change? Darwin accounted for this change by the theory of what he called natural selection. He held that nature was a delicate balance between a rapid birth rate, a limited food supply, and natural, accidental, hereditary changes. Looking at nature, he recognized that every new generation, every generation of children is numerically larger, all things being equal, than the generation of their parents. If you allow generations to multiply unchecked, there will soon come a time when there is not enough food, not enough subsistence for all the individuals of that species. At this time, a struggle for survival takes place. Now, some individuals of every family are different in strength and body characteristic than their brothers and their sisters. A giraffe may have an elongated neck which allows it to reach and to take the topmost leaves of the tree. A zebra may have a peculiar kind of striation which adds to his natural protective camouflage. These accidental characteristics of birth allow the animal an advantage in the struggle for survival. It is that animal which survives. It is that animal which reproduces. And in time, it is these characteristics among the animals which can reproduce, which become dominant in the species, and finally, ultimately, destroy or blot out, make secondary the earlier non-successful characteristics. A change takes place. And this change takes place under natural causes, because birth differentiates and because nature gives advantage to certain adaptive characteristics. Darwin thought that this concept of natural selection could account for almost all the changes which had taken place in the 2 or 3 billion years of life history. Was man, too, the product of evolution? Did he, like the giraffe and the zebra and all other animals, come into being as a product of growth from lower, less successfully adaptive forms? Logic would answer yes. But when Darwin first published in 1859 his Origin of Species, he was unwilling to make this final link in the chain of his logic. He was probably unwilling to challenge many of the sensibilities of his Victorian compatriots. But others of his disciples, notably Thomas Huxley, quickly made this claim. And in 1871, Charles Darwin finally published a companion volume to The Origin of Species, which he entitled The Descent of Man, a volume in which he argued that man, too, was a product of evolution, that man had in his family tree, apes and monkeys and quadrupeds, reptiles and fish, birds, and all the simple organisms which breed by the billions in our seas and our banks of mud and clay. Thus, from the war of nature, he writes, from famine and death, the most exalted objects which we are capable of conceiving, namely the production of the higher animals and ultimately the production of man, directly follows. There is grandeur in this view of life, with its several powers having been originally breathed by the Creator into a few forms or into one. And that while as this planet has gone cycling on according to the fixed law of gravity from so simple a beginning, endless forms most beautiful and most wonderful have been and are being evolved. And Darwin was right. Those who were conscious in England of their genealogies, the blue bloods, were very much taken aback by suddenly finding simians and monkeys of all types among their ancestors. Today we know that the line of evolution is much more complex and diversified than Darwin knew it to be. Darwin was unaware of the experiments of the monk Gregor Mendel. He knew nothing of genes and of chromosomes, of the mechanics of heredity. He knew nothing of the science of genetics as such. In his day, the sciences of embryology and paleontology and plant geography and statistics were nascent science just beginning to develop systems and organizations of their own. Darwin did not know that the force of mutations, of the erratic changes of heredity in nature. We now know that natural selection cannot account for all or even perhaps most of the changes which have taken place in the evolutionary growth of man. We are not sure that we can describe many of the great changes which have taken place. But as piece after piece has been fit into the evolutionary picture, the scientist is more and more sure that Darwin was essentially right in this, that there is a continuity of life from the beginnings of life on our Earth, and that in this continuum, the simpler forms have been gradually replaced and changed and developed into more complex forms. Darwin gave us great insight into our world. Darwin's studies propelled generation upon generation of men to study the interrelationships of man and nature, the origin of the institutions of man, comparative anatomy, embryology, and many of our basic sciences. But unfortunately, the theories of evolution, and especially the theory of natural selection, were seized upon by some social thinkers and social critics in Darwin's day, as in our own, and were misconstrued and misapplied with sometimes quite mischievous results. A social thinker, historian, and philosopher by the name of Herbert Spencer had determined that there was such a thing as evolution in nature long before Darwin had proved that there was. And he argued that this was nature's way of improving the breed, that the giraffe with the elongated neck and the zebra with the unique striations was an improvement. He argued that this was nature's way of insisting upon what he called the survival of the fittest. And then he argued from the animal kingdom to human life itself. He argued that the struggle for survival, for wealth, for family security, individual survival among men, is the way in which society, nature, breeds a better breed of man. He argued that all of our attempts to be charitable, to be kindly, to protect the less successful, the indigent, and the poor are misguided, if well-intentioned. That what we ought to do is to permit free competition in the arena of work, of occupation, and that though it is hard to see suffering and misery, this is nature's way of destroying the unfit. And in time, this kind of free competition would breed a superior type of human being. Now, unfortunately, fitness in human terms is quite another than fitness in animal terms. It is doubtful whether a Moses or a Jeremiah or a Jesus would be fit to survive in the marketplace. Certainly, animal cunning and shrewdness and physical strength are not the marks of the saint or of the artist, the scholar, the religious leader, the teacher, all the men who cement together and give dimension and depth to what we call human society and human life. Fitness in human terms is something infinitely more complex, difficult to describe than fitness in animal terms. And breeding sheer physical strength, sheer acquisitive instinct in the human species is certainly not the way of improving the human breed. But taking their key from Spencer's arguments, all those who argue to retain the status quo, peculiar economic advantage and privilege, all those who wish to prevent the unionization of labor, all those who wish to prevent child welfare legislation, all those who wish to prevent federal governments from providing aid to the indigent and the poor, took their key and argued that it was an act of kindness to allow suffering, because this was the way in which nature quickly did away with human weakness and inadequacy. The whole pseudoscience of eugenics, the so-called scientific breeding of the human species, took its mark from the works of Herbert Spencer. All of it presumes that there is such a thing as a white gene or a Western gene or a wealthy gene which you can somehow breed, and by breeding improve the human species, forgetting the genius and saintliness and creativity. No. Neither race, nor creed, nor color, nor status, nor economic capacity. Now, largely, Mr. Spencer's views have by our day been shown to be not only wrong, but outmoded. But it's still occasionally we hear a realistic individual, and I put this word in quotation marks, argue or convince, try to convince some of his younger colleagues that one must be tough-minded in this world. That if business requires it, one must put aside an old employee, even though he cannot be retrained for some other business. That we ought not to allow our sympathy for human suffering to destroy the nest egg, the capital, which we have laid away for some rainy day. Unfortunately, it is tender-mindedness, not tough-mindedness, which has made human civilization that great and glorious thing which we enjoy today. Alone of all the animals which inhabit the earth, the human being requires a protected childhood. And if our parents set personal pleasure above child care, none of us would as children have survived. If our parents did not allow us the prolonged 20, 25 years of growth and education, none of us would be equipped for business or professional capacities. If it had not been for those who were willing to sacrifice, willing to give of themselves, the saints, the decent, godly people of any generation, our society would not be cemented together, but it would have long since fragmentized itself, and the bones of the human race would be fossils, as are the bones of the dinosaurs in their life. And the views of Charles Darwin were used also by some to attack religion. One of the classic debates between religion and science was based upon the theory of evolution. It was argued first that evolution had disproved the Bible. The Bible said that the world was created in 6 days, that man came into being on the sixth day of creation. Evolution spoke of a 2 or 3 billion year history of human life before the creation of man. How can you believe, how can such a book be creditable, which teaches such scientific tommy rot? Secondly, it was argued that the Bible teaches that man was created by God in his own image, that man has a spiritual kinship to God, but did not evolution prove that man's kinship was to the lower forms of animal, not to the higher spiritual forms, which we call God? And finally, it was argued that the world as we know it shows no purpose, no God-given plan, that it is a world of happenstance and chance, the blind breeding and struggling, a cruel world, a brutal world of struggle for survival, in which only the accidental few have the capacity for survival. In the half century immediately succeeding the publication of The Origin of Species, some of Darwin's disciples spent almost as much time baiting the ecclesiastics of their generation as they did seeking to remove many of the obstacles which still impeded a full understanding of the mechanics of evolution itself. In England, Thomas Huxley seemed every week or so to be mounting some debating platform. And in Germany, Ernst Haeckel, an embryologist of great capacity, delighted to spend almost all of his leisure time fulminating against the supernaturalist revealed religions and arguing that ours was a godless evolutionary universe and that all men ought quickly to put aside all their misguided notions about God and about divine purpose and about faith and about prayer and the spiritual capacities of man. The century has now passed. And the century has given all of us a great deal of perspective. We now know that both the defenders of faith and the attackers of faith misunderstood the grounds on which the discussion, the exchange of ideas, should have taken place. Yes, it is true. It was true as you heard it read this morning. The Bible does say that the world was created in 6 days. But already 1,500 years before Darwin, the Talmud had suggested that the biblical days of creation were measured by some other clock besides the clock of man. And as I indicated to you in the 14th century, Levi ben Gershon indicated that this whole passage was to be taken metaphorically, allegorically, poetically, and it was to indicate evolution, the development of simpler forms of life into higher forms of life. Indeed, the Jew, our ancestors, had always read these creation legends of the Bible metaphorically. They called it midrashically. They knew that the biblical science was not the final word in science. They knew that the import of the first chapter of Genesis was a philosophic, a theological lesson, not a scientific lesson. That it was intended to portray the majesty of God's handiwork, his potential power through creation. There has never been in Jewish life a debate between the evolutionist and the religionist on the issue of creation itself. Far from attacking the standards of religion, the Bible's credibility, the Jew looked upon the doctrine of evolution as another proof of the Bible's credibility, as proof of the majesty of creation and of the beauty of God's handiwork. Fundamentalism, the belief that the literal surface meaning of the Bible is true, has never been a part of our faith. It is the part only of adolescent faith. To read the Bible maturely is to read it philosophically, to read it midrashically, poetically, metaphorically. And the Jew has read the Bible in this way since it was first written. What of man? What of the Bible's claimed kinship of man to God? In the image of God created he him, after his own likeness created he him. I think it was Alfred North Whitehead, the great British mathematician and scientist, who first observed that Darwin's theory of evolution accounts for the changes in the material world as we know it. But he nowhere even asked the question how this These changes of material phenomena such as we know account for such a man as Shakespeare or as Newton. Man thinks, man sings, man creates, man paints, man prophesies, man has religious insight, man teaches. Man has these capacities and no evolutionist would deny it. No other animal has it. The evolutionist has first of all never been able to describe how this great jump is taken between the animal world and the world of man. And secondly, are these not the very capacities which make man godlike? And should we not all of us remember that it was Maimonides 500 years before Darwin and his disciples who first suggested that the concept in the image of God created he him was to be taken metaphorically, not as literal truth? Again, if we read the Bible as our ancestors read the Bible, we have no conflict here between science and religion. For science, too, is amazed by man, and it is, after all, the scientist himself who has given us this understanding, this puzzlement about the nature of man. And what about the question of purpose in our universe? What about the claim of the evolutionist or some evolutionist that nature is red of tooth and claw? That nature knows only cruelty and brutality, that creation is a form is a matter of chance accidents of birth and nothing more. Well, there is brutality and there is cruelty in life. Even though he slay me, yet will I believe in him. It was Job, not Darwin, who was first disturbed and first wrestled with the question of how to justify God's ways to man. And we cannot justify these ways. But there is another way of looking at this question. There's not only the question of cruelty in the world, but there is the amazing fact of accomplishment in the world. There is man. And no mathematical theory of statistics can give us any probability which would establish the fact that blind chance is working on some infinitesimal bacteria bit of life 2 billion years ago would create any of the great religious, artists, scholars, teachers of our day. Man is not an inevitable concomitant of a world of chance. Man can be explained only in a world of purpose. How else can you think of a being who has the capacity to sacrifice himself for an ideal, to limit his activity to protect his children, to add beauty to an already magnificent world, and above all else, to use his mind to understand and develop the framework, the structure of that world? Professor Lauren Isley is head of the Department of Anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania. He's curator of their Museum of Ancient History, Prehistory. He's a competent evolutionist, biologist, as well as anthropologist. I recently came across these words of his, which I should like to share with you. He is thinking ahead to a day when the evolutionist will be able to answer many of the conundrums of scientific evolution which they cannot yet answer. A day when they will explain how life came into being, how the simplest forms of life became the one-celled animals, which are in essence infinitely complex, how the animals as we know it became man. The instinct-ridden animal became the concept-conscious man. If the day comes, he writes, when the slime of the laboratory for the first time crawls under man's direction, we shall have great need of humbleness. It will be difficult for us to believe in our pride of achievement that the secret of life has slipped through our fingers and still eludes us. We will list all the chemicals and all the reactions. The men who have become gods will pose austerely before the popping flashbulbs of news photographers. And there will be few to consider, so deep is the mindset of an age, whether the desire to link life to matter may not have blinded us to the more remarkable characteristics of both. As for me, If I am still around on that day, I intend to put on my old hat, to climb over the wall as usual. I shall see strange mechanisms lying as they lie here now in the autumn rain. Strange pipes that transported the substance of life, the intricate seed case out of which the life has flown. I shall observe no thing green, no delicate transpiration of leaves, no subtle comings and goings of vapor. The little sunlit factories of the chloroplasts will have dissolved away into common earth. Beautiful, angular, and bare, the machinery of life will lie exposed as it is now to my view. There will be the thin blue skeleton of a hair, tumbled in a little heap, and crouching over it, I will marvel as I marvel now, at the wonderful correlation of parts, the perfect adaptation to purpose, the individually vanished and yet persisting pattern, which is now hopping on some other hill. I will wonder, as always, in what manner particles pursue such devious plans and symmetries. I will ask once more in what way it is managed that the simple dust takes on a history and begins to weave those unique and never-recurring apparitions in the stream of time. I shall wonder what strange forces at the heart of matter regulate the tiny beating of a rabbit's heart or the dim dream that builds a milkweed pod. It is said by men who know about these things that the smallest living cell probably contains over a quarter of a million protein molecules engaged in the multitudinous coordinated activities which make up the phenomenon of life. At the instant of death, whether of man or microbe, that ordered, incredible spinning passes away in an almost furious haste of those same particles to get themselves back into the chaotic, unplanned earth. I do not think if someone finally twists the key successfully in the tiniest and most humble house of life, that many of these questions will be answered, or that the thick forces which create lights in the deep sea, the living batteries in the waters of tropical swamps, or the dead cycles of parasites, or the most noble workings of the human brain will be much, if at all, revealed. Rather, I would say that if dead matter has reared up this curious landscape of fiddling crickets, song sparrows, and wondering men, it must be plain even to the most devoted materialist that the matter of which he speaks contains amazing, if not dreadful, powers, and may not impossibly be but one mask of many worn by the great face behind. Evolution, rightly understood, makes man humble again before the miraculous majesty of God's created nature. It has not unlocked and solved for us the secret mysteries of life. It has given us a new insight, a new dimension of scientific understanding. But the mystery remains. Man remains. The capacity of our mind to reach out beyond the selfish needs of survival remains. And above all else, God remains in his heaven as he has always been, conscious of our needs, conscious of our wonderment and of our puzzlement, determined as only he can be determined to help us little by little understand the world in which we live, build on this world such a civilization as he would wish and will.